but close. She studies the wrinkles in her skirt where her fists balled the cloth. She's aware of sweat trickling inside her sleeveless blouse. She takes a dish towel and sticks it straight down between her breasts to wipe away the moisture there, and then lays the towel at the back of her neck. Jean will say they can't afford 3 children. Or perhaps, feeling guilty, he'll say nothing at all. She will have to tell Jean. No, she won't. She'll let him look at her and wonder. He will have to say it aloud. By then, he'll have done the calculations and will know the night on which they conceived the child. Grace wonders if the way the sperm is put into the woman affects the personality of the child. No, of course not. She knows a wife's tale when she hears one. The heat reduces them to looser versions of themselves. Grace lacks the energy to cook a proper meal, but can't get away with sandwiches. Some afternoons she picks up the hose in the backyard, bends her head, and lets the cool water run down her neck and back and hair, shivering with physical pleasure. At night she can't bear the cotton nightgown, the fan at the window moving sweltering air from outside to inside. She worries about Tom, who develops a bad diaper rash. Grace knows she has to visit Dr. Franklin to confirm the pregnancy. Her mother guesses soon after Grace knows. Grace says, "I don't want it." Her mother's eyes widen. "Promise me," she says. "I promise," Grace replies, knowing there's no alternative. Perhaps if she lived in Portland or Boston, she would know where to go for such a thing. But she's never heard of anyone in Hunts Beach who could help her get rid of a fetus. Probably Dr. Franklin knows how, but she can't ask him. He wouldn't do it anyway. During the first week of September, Grace begins to wish for rain. All the brilliant sunshine feels unnatural. She knows others think it too, but don't mention it for fear of triggering the endless rains of spring. As if a thought could trigger weather. Grace makes herself bigger dresses. Her mother buys her a maternity blouse and helps her daughter let out the elastic in her skirts. The first evening she dons these clothes, Jean says, when he walks into the kitchen, "You're pregnant."
"You noticed."
"How far are you along?" "Guess." There's a long silence. Grace knows she's on dangerous ground.
"Are you happy about it?" asks Jean.
"Are you?" Grace doesn't expect an answer, and she doesn't need one.
"I hear the water level in the lakes and ponds is low," he says.
"Is that right?"
"I'll be out mowing the lawn."
Through the window, Grace watches her husband push the mower, trailing clouds of dust behind him. Grace makes an appointment with Dr. Franklin, a man who wastes no time in small talk, who enters houses and walks straight up the stairs to the patient's room before the family even knows he's there. He studies Grace's chart.
"I thought so," he says. "This is your third in less than 2 years."
"More or less." With a gesture, he makes her spread her legs.
"You need any information about protection?"
he asks as he inserts his fingers into her vagina. "No," she says, "but my husband might." She has never used this smart tone with the doctor. He knows her as intimately as anyone, she supposes. He brought her into the world.
"You're how old?"
he asks as he manipulates her insides. Grace winces with the discomfort. 23.
"You might think of slowing down," he says, withdrawing his hands.
Grace doesn't know how to answer this. Does he mean slow down the lovemaking? She can hardly slow down something that never happens.
"You can sit up now."
Grace does as asked, drawing the gown across her breasts, which he has already seen and palpated. The office smells the same each time she visits, a mix of chemicals she can't name. When she was a child, the smells frightened her, and she had to be dragged across the threshold. Now she finds them an odd comfort.
You're not happy about this, are you?
He asks as he wipes his hands. He is getting to be an older man, she sees now, his hair nearly white, his glasses not quite hiding the bags under his eyes.
It's too soon.
In some countries they wouldn't say so, but they wear out their women. We don't want to wear you out, though, do we?
She already feels worn out. She thinks of all the extra years of diapers and bottles.
But you'll be in the enviable position, 5 years from now, of having had your babies, and of having a close-knit, ready-made family.
She forms a snappy reply, but there's no point in taking out her anger on this kind man who wants only to help.
The pregnancy and delivery will cost $80, he says. I know it's more than Tom cost, but I had to raise my prices by $5 this year.
That's fine, she says.
Abruptly, he says to get dressed, and then he leaves the room. If he had something to tell her about the pregnancy, he would have. She and the baby must be all right. The waiting room is full of patients. Beautiful day melds into beautiful day. The beach becomes so crowded that not a single blanket will fit after 10 o'clock in the morning. Claire begs for the wading pool as soon as she wakes up. Grace dangles Tom in the tepid water. The ice house runs low, and there are days at a time when Grace has no refrigeration in the kitchen. She and Rosie begin to shop every day at Gardner's so that they can eat what is fresh and not be worried about cold storage. The corn is good. The tomatoes are fleshy. Cantaloupes are as small as softballs, and watermelons enormous. At night, Jean and she eat the watermelons outdoors and spit the seeds into the grass. One evening, after the kids are asleep, Jean says,
"Let's go to bed."
Grace doesn't know whether this means that he is tired or that he wants to make love. She has her answer in the bed when he faces her, side by side. His penis is hard, and he makes her feel it, but when she lifts her leg and shifts so that he can enter her, his penis softens. Grace, worried because she knows she has to make this work, begins to stroke him, but she must be doing it wrong, because he stops her hand and says,
"I'm sorry."
She says,
"Don't be."
After they have broken apart, Grace wonders, for the first time, if Jean is somehow just as perplexed as she is. Might he, in his own way, be trying as hard to make sense of the marriage he is in? Grace doesn't feel a flood of love, however, but rather a sensation of pity. She doesn't want to pity her husband. A fine haze is on the horizon when Jean drives Grace and the children to his mother's house, now officially Jean's. It's located 4 miles to the south of Hunts Beach and sits on a promontory with a view of rocky shore and ocean. Grace has been to her mother-in-law's home only half a dozen times, twice memorably before the wedding, when Mrs. Holland was barely able to conceal her distrust of what she called Grace's wiles, the ones that got her pregnant and ensnared her son before he had completed his studies. Grace thought then, and does so now, that Merle couldn't possibly have believed, during an intelligent moment, that her son shared none of the blame. The Ford climbs a winding drive to the house, a well-kept Victorian, painted green with white trim that emphasizes the intricate woodwork around the doors and windows and along the wide front porch. Mr. Holland, before he died, owned stocks and bonds, about which Grace knows nothing except that they provided Merle Holland with a comfortable income. Jean takes Tom in his arms, and Grace holds Claire's hand as they step up onto the porch. Grace turns to take in the sweep of the coastline. Jean fiddles with a set of keys, and they are in. Her husband's face tightens as he enters the dark house with its long hallway to the back, its enclosed sitting room to the right, and the turret room to the left. Grace wonders if her husband is sad or horrified. He opens the French doors to the sitting room. Grace wants to open every window. She rolls a fringed shade to let light in, and Jean scowls as if she shouldn't have done that.
The view is great, she says.
The sun will let in the heat, Jean announces, as if parroting an oft-repeated statement of Merle's.
Do you think the furniture will mind?
Don't touch anything, Jean says to Claire, but the warning, Grace knows, is for her.
Ignoring him, she raises the shade. In the scrutiny of the bright sun, the house shows its age. The wallpaper, a maroon pattern, reveals white plaster where it's peeling. All the woodwork has been stained a dark mahogany. Claire clings to Grace's leg, but Grace has no need to cling to anyone. Did the lack of light twist the plant that grew here? Moving quickly, she passes through a dining room with a table no child has ever been allowed to eat at, and into the kitchen with its back windows overlooking the garden. The room, painted pale yellow and white, is a haven. Claire, feeling it, runs along the linoleum, and Grace finds her wooden utensils to play with.
This I like, Grace says.
Jean, not looking at her, nods, as if his mother were right. The kitchen is the place for the help. Grace doubts Merle ever visited her kitchen because she had Clodagh to cook and clean for her. When Jean visited with the children, it was Clodagh who had cookies for Claire and a perfectly warmed bottle for Tom. Clodagh, to whom Jean has given her last pay packet. What will happen to the woman? Outside, the gardens are withering from lack of rain. Grace remembers them as glorious, the result of Merle's expertise and Joe the gardener's efforts. Jean coaxes them out of the kitchen and up the stairs to the second floor, given over entirely to Mrs. Holland's bedroom, dressing room, bathroom, and a piano in the turret. Grace marvels at so much space for one woman, a space much larger, she is certain, than her own home. She touches fabric and silver, writing paper and pens. She fingers necklaces hanging from an ornate mirror, a challenge that Jean doesn't rise to. He wants me to like it here, she thinks. He doesn't announce their future until they are on the third floor, inspecting the guest rooms, all of which share a bathroom with wooden fixtures and a chain pull for the toilet. Jean invites her to glance out a window in the bedroom that used to be his. The view is majestic.
You can see ships traveling from Boston to Portland from here, he says.
Grace catches Claire by a foot before she crawls beneath a bed.
So what do you think? Jean asks.
Of the house? It's enormous.
About moving here.
She has known, ever since the second floor, that Jean would ask this. And though she wants to scream an immediate no, she understands she has to tread carefully.
It's grand, she says, but it's isolated. I don't know who the children would play with. They can't get off the property unless they cross the coast road, and only then to rocks and sea. How will they walk to school when the time comes?
There's a bus, Jean says. That's how I got to school.
I do love the kitchen, but the house is too much for us. I'd be working day and night.
You already work day and night.
No, I don't.
Well, this has to be easier in some ways, he points out. More room to store things.
This seems to Grace a weak argument. What things? Is it your idea that we would sleep downstairs and the kids would sleep up here?
Well, we'd have the baby with us for the first several months.
And Tom and Claire upstairs where we couldn't hear them. Jean sniffs. Grace thinks of Rosie. Who would be her neighbor here? Aren't the taxes high?
There's no mortgage.
We wouldn't get much for the bungalow, she says of a house that is heavily mortgaged.
We wouldn't need it if we lived here.
All our savings would go to taxes and upkeep, she argues.
I'll get a raise soon.
She sneezes. Then she sneezes again.
She apologizes and sneezes a third time.
It's dusty up here, Jean says. Nothing a good clean won't help.
Grace had no idea she could fake a sneeze so well.
I can't do it, she says. She hates the house, the Victorian dark, the fringed lampshades, the heavy mahogany furniture. The weight of the dwelling makes her hungry for air.
I think this is my decision to make, don't you?
No, I don't.
Grace, for God's sake, be quiet.
Claire looks from one parent to the other. Somewhere, far away, someone is smashing a sandcastle. At her own mother's house, after the iced tea and the peek at the layette Marjorie is knitting, her mother asks,
How are you and Jean?
Times are a little tough right now, Grace says.
Financially?
No.
Is it the stress of the new baby coming?
I could say yes, Grace confesses, but that wouldn't be accurate. Her mother wets Tom's cheek with the icy side of her glass, and he pulls away, giggling. He comes back for more.
What's good in your life? Her mother asks.
Grace, surprised, needs to think.
I have two beautiful children.
And?
I have a house I like, a friend next door, and a washing machine.
And?
We're all healthy.
And? Grace shortstops her mother because she knows where this is going.
And I have a husband who provides for us, who is good with the children, and who is handsome.
She does not add that she thinks Jean is deeply troubled. Dry turns into drought. The word is on everyone's tongue and is spoken at least once a day. Underfoot, the grass crunches. Men digging at the side of the highway to put in a rest stop report that the top 6 inches of soil is dust. On the roads of Hunts Beach, vehicles kick up smothering plumes behind them, and women begin again to keep the wet wash in the house for fear that tiny particles of dirt will stick to the laundry. Grace isn't certain when the days of sunshine turn from beneficial to unnatural, but she thinks it happens near the end of September, after everyone has returned to school and many of the summer people are gone. The niggling sense of something wrong slowly turns to mild alarm. The mums and roses have withered at the edges of her yard. Grace expects the nights to be cooler, but they aren't. For the first time in over a year, she prays for rain. Spark. By the beginning of October, inland farmers have to haul water for livestock because the wells have gone dry. Brooks are still. Lake levels drop. Dust and wood smoke lay at the horizon. The best summer in years, someone says at the store. The state issues a directive warning its citizens to put out cigarettes and matches in water jugs. During an idle moment, Grace drops a lit cigarette onto the ground just to see what will happen. The grass catches fire and spreads faster than she ever imagined. With her jar of water, she douses the fire before it reaches a pile of dry brush Jean raked to one side. Tendrils of flames, however, have slipped behind her and race toward the house. She stomps and stomps, then runs into the kitchen, stops the washer, and flips the lever to allow the soapy water to fall onto the grass. Catching it in her jar, she soaks the fire until it is well and truly out. Winded, she sits on the porch steps and bows her head, ashamed of her stupid experiment. She is awed by the wiles of the fire. Hunters report on opening day that leaf drop and pine needles disintegrate upon touch. There's a great deal of talk about whether or not it's safe to shoot a gun. The colored leaves crumple in the hand before hues can be appreciated. When Grace was a child, she would find the brightest reds, and her mother would iron them in waxed paper so that they could be preserved. Grace remembers satisfying packets of color on the kitchen table. She's sad that she can't do this for Claire,
who would love to touch the waxed leaves. Jean reports that a crew working on the turnpike set a fire to clear land. Firemen put it out only to discover the next day that it had gone underground and had popped up at the roots of several trees. Again, the fires were put out. The next day, they broke out in more spots.
The fire runs underground? Grace asks.
Yep.
She imagines secret fires tunneling beneath the house.
But how? There's no oxygen.
There's oxygen in peat and dead vegetation, Jean explains.
The fires move slowly beneath the surface, he adds, burning enough to bring more oxygen into the soil. They can burn, undetected, for months, for years. A fire that goes underground in late fall can pop up in spring. The idea fascinates Grace. If she were to go out in bare feet and walk in the fields, would she come upon the sensation of heat underfoot? She finds it difficult not to assign menacing characteristics to the underground fires, just as she once attached them to the sea. Fall planting isn't possible because dry soil can't be laid over the furrows. Ponds are lower than they've been in 30 years. In one arid pond, a farmer finds what appears to be the remains of an old road. Fire, and not drought, is the word on everyone's tongue. When Grace is in her fifth month, she climbs into the attic to find her woolens because she still has winter maternity clothes. But as she opens the box and fingers the heaviness of the fabrics, she knows it's too soon. The temperatures haven't been below 80 degrees in 2 weeks. All the women are still wearing cotton. In ancient times, the natives would have made much of the unnatural season, which seems to have no name. It can't rightly be called Indian summer, because there hasn't yet been a frost. The elders of the tribe would have come together to puzzle out what the summer into summer could possibly mean. Had they offended their ancestors? Would it remain summer for months? For years? Would they fear to die? Fear that the planet would die? What was the remedy for such a thing? Dust enters the house and coats every object. When Grace scrubs her face at night, she can feel a fine grit under the washcloth. Grace has a birthday party for Claire in the backyard and stands ready with a pitcher of lemonade over the two candles on the cake. The girl stands on her chair and blows out the candles with a flourish and is pleased with herself. Rosie, cigarette in hand, takes a long drag and then flips it onto the ground. Grace races around the table and pours lemonade over the butt, splashing Rosie's shoes.
"What are you doing?" Rosie squawks, jumping back. "I dropped a butt on the lawn the other day, and the fire spread like..."
"Wildfire?" Rosie offers, smiling. She pulls another cigarette and the lighter from her purse, but then thinks better of the idea and replaces them. Grace wakes every morning to see if the world has sorted itself out. The fine grit that she felt on her face seems to have entered her eyes and nose and head, for there are particles in her brain where there weren't before. If Jean is taciturn, Grace is sharp, as if she had broken glass on her skin. She tries hard not to snap at the children, but can't help herself with Jean.
"I thought you were going to clean the screens," she announces the minute Jean walks in the door. "You've got to find me some ice," she insists the following day.
"How would I know?" she answers when Jean asks, "When's dinner?" She wants to be a better person, but she can't when there's grit in her teeth. One morning, Grace takes the children to the beach, where other townspeople stand. There's no chatter, no fond hellos, only the sight of fog close to shore. The east light shines through the mist, revealing a lobster boat at work. This is the closest that moisture has come to Hunt's Beach in weeks. It seems a promise. Grace and the children wait for the fog to move closer still, as if, were they to wade into the ocean, it would envelop them and put water droplets on their skin and lips. The desire for moisture becomes nearly overwhelming, and she notes that several people, men and women, walk into the ocean. Will they try to make it all the way to the mist, or will the fog peel back as they do so? Only a tease. One by one, the townspeople return to their homes. Rosie and Grace angle toward one another.
What a colossal disappointment, Rosie sighs.
Grace begins to long for an embrace, a kiss. She begins to associate bright sunny days with marital trouble. She thinks that maybe her marriage has gone underground.
Have you considered speaking with Reverend Phillips? Grace's mother asks.
What?
Asks a startled Grace. Your minister. You know he went to Harvard Divinity School.
What's that got to do with anything?
He counsels couples, says her mother. Women, and men too, probably. I know for a fact that Dot Truitt and her husband went to see him for counseling.
And how did that work out? Grace asks.
They're still married.
Which tells Grace nothing.
I couldn't, she says. He's heard it all, I'm sure. What's so different about you and Jean?
Grace, annoyed, says, We don't talk, and we don't have sex. Her mother looks shocked and then pained. She purses her mouth in a way that Grace remembers from her childhood and points to Grace's stomach.
So how did that get in there?
That was the last time, Grace says, and it was horrible.
I don't want to hear any more, her mother says, standing and walking out of the room.
When she returns, her mind seems to be made up.
Go, she says. I'll watch the children. You get yourself over to the church and see if you can find Reverend Phillips.
Grace leaves Claire and Tom with her mother and walks not to the church, but to Rosie's. When her friend opens the door, Grace says,
We don't have sex.
If Rosie is taken aback by the pronouncement, she doesn't show it.
Not at all?
She asks, gesturing for Grace to come inside.
Not since...
Grace points at her belly.
And even then, it was terrible.
Rosie clears a dessert plate, a rubber duck, and a washcloth from the sofa.
The children are napping.
Grace can see from the wrappers on the side table that Rosie was reading magazines and eating Tootsie Rolls during her time off. Rosie hands Grace a glass of water.
I always knew you weren't completely happy in your marriage. Sometime it used to waft off you in waves. What's wrong with Jean anyway?
I don't know. He doesn't ever want to see my face. He doesn't care if I'm enjoying it or not. She pauses.
Sex, I mean. It's always been like this?
Pretty much. Grace can see Rosie tried to mask both surprise and dismay.
Have you ever enjoyed it? Her friend asks quietly.
Maybe I did in the beginning, Grace answers, but then she realizes that Rosie is speaking of the god-awful joy she once gleefully mentioned.
Well, no, not in the way you're thinking.
Rosie is silent. Grace can feel heat rising in her face.
I didn't ever want you to know. You and Tim.
Me and Tim, Rosie says, sighing.
Every marriage has its problems.
But you like sex, Grace says.
I do.
I don't, at least the way it is now. I don't even know if I'd like it ever. Jean's a good man. Well, he used to be a good man.
I'm embarrassed I had to tell you this. I started to talk to my mother about it, but that was a big mistake.
When she looks down, an inch of brandy has replaced the water.
Can't hurt, Rosie says, raising her glass. You've been shaking ever since you walked in the door.
You're a good friend, Grace says.
I want to be.
You are. The two women clink glasses, and Grace starts to laugh.
Oh, Rosie, you saved me from telling the minister. That's where my mother thought I was going.
You were going to use the word sex with your minister? Rosie asks, incredulous. Grace reads in the newspaper reports of fires in Waldeboro, Topsham, and Lisbon Falls. The news is always one or two days old, and Grace ponders the fate of the people in the stories. What, for example, happened to the house of the man who soaked it with a hose as the fire approached? Did he save it? Or to the gentleman who fled with his tax returns? Did he lose them in the fierce winds created by the fire? Or to the woman who begged to be allowed to take her refrigerator? By the next day, there are news stories to report, and no follow-ups. How did the woman intend to transport her treasured appliance? Many of the stories mention that there is no early warning system for fire in Maine. Often the first sign is the smell of smoke, followed by a vehicle racing into town with a man in it, ordering citizens to evacuate. Houses go up like bombs. Animals, trapped in burning barns, die. The ones freed at the last minute sometimes make it to safety. Her sweaty arm sticks to the newspaper as she tries to turn the page. The women of Hunts Beach are rarely seen walking alone without a purse or a child or a carriage. Grace, having left her children with her mother, walks out of her house with no destination. In a loose maternity skirt and sleeveless blouse, she lets her arms swing as she moves. Because she always heads south toward the village center, this time she goes north. Most people have left the waterfront cottages for home, school, and work. The natives tend to live two or three streets back, as she does. But occasionally she sees a window open, a rake leaning against a tree, a carved pumpkin on the front steps. As she strolls, the seashore becomes rockier with surf, a pleasant meditative sound. She is thrilled to be moving faster than she can with the kids, stretching her legs, uncoiling the cat inside. She lets her mind empty, or tries to. What would she take if someone, this very minute, were to tell her she must evacuate her house? Her children, of course, and bottles for Tom. Clean clothes for Claire. Perhaps a change of clothes for herself tucked behind the children in the carriage. A photograph of her wedding? Of the children when they were younger? Yes, one or two. A picture of her father. The layette for the baby? Her purse. An address book? Cigarettes? But then what would happen? She can't outrun a fire. Perhaps she might be able to hoist the children in a suitcase onto the back of a truck. But she can't get rid of the image of herself on foot, pushing the carriage as fast as she can, trying to shush Claire, who would smell and sense, if not actually see, the danger. No one needs to explain a wildfire to a child. Normally, Grace loves this time of year. It's not just the turning of the leaves or the crisp weather that one expects. It's more a feeling of relaxation while the rest of the world becomes busier. With fewer people in town, streets are less crowded. Quiet descends. This year, however, that sense of peace has curdled to one of nervous watching. It's bound to rain sometime soon, they say. It has to rain someday, they moan.
Hey, Missy.
The name jolts Grace, who turns to look. A man calls to her from inside a black Ford across the street. At first, she thinks it might be Jean teasing her, but then she notices that the driver has a straw hat. Jean never wears a straw hat.
Lady, can you give me some directions?
Where do you want to go? She shouts back, putting a hand over her eyes so that she can get a better look at the man's face. Middle-aged, a little soft.
Well, I want to go to Cape Porpoise, and I got a map here.
Grace hesitates. But why? As she approaches the automobile, she discovers that the man's shoulders are bare. In the heat, many men have shed their shirts. He must not be very tall, she decides, because his neck barely clears the bottom of the window. How does he see out to drive? How can I help you? She asks.
Well, I got this map here.
She bends to take a better look. The man is naked and is touching himself. He grins up at her. The missing tooth,
the fold of flesh at the belly, the limp penis. She slowly backs away, ignoring the man's catcalls. She steps onto the grass, then onto the sidewalk. She reverses direction. She walks with her head bent, her shoulders hunched, praying he won't follow. To see a soft, naked man inside a heavy metal machine. To have been tricked into having to watch, if only for a second, the man fondling himself. She knows her face is red and that sweat is trickling down the inside of her blouse. Why do men do this? She asks herself. Not the touching, she understands that well enough. But the stealth, the wanting to hurt women, to trick them. Rosie would have laughed and said something vulgar about the size of the man's penis. If only she had Rosie's nerve, her ability to think on her feet. When Grace reaches the beach, she heads for the water. She takes off her shoes and walks in. She did not go home because she didn't want the man, if he was following her, to know where she lives. If he stops at the beach, she won't leave the water. If he gets out of the car and starts to move in her direction, she'll scream and run like hell. But wait, he can't get out of his car. He's naked. She sits on the sand, knees up, only her feet in the shallow waves. She would love to go for a swim. The coolness, the cleansing, her head diving under the water, coming up for air. How good that would feel. Why not? Except for the knee length of her cotton skirt, what she has on is not all that different from a maternity bathing suit. What if the baby weighs her down? No, it won't. With all her extra blubber, she ought to float effortlessly. The idle thought becomes a desire. The desire takes on a sense of urgency. She stands and walks into the water up to her knees. She lifts her skirt a bit and runs and stumbles, but then she turns and executes a backstroke the way she was taught so long ago at summer camp. Her skirt floats up beside her, and her legs are free to make any movement they want. She dives, reaching for an underwater breaststroke. When she comes up for air, she is not at the same place at which she entered. The current has carried her along with it. She squints, and in the distance she sees a black Ford cross an intersection. Lots of people drive black Fords. Her husband for one, the minister for another. She will never tell anyone, not Jean, not Rosie, not her mother, about the incident with the man in the car. She floats with her arms out beside her. She lets the waves push her closer to shore. She catches a scent she doesn't normally associate with the ocean. She stands and sniffs again. A faint whiff of smoke. Someone burning leaves? Yes, that must be it. But the air seems slightly hazy to the west. The black Ford rounds a corner and begins to come along the beach road. Grace thinks of ducking below the surface, but then sees that there are two men in the car. On the top of the automobile is a bullhorn. Fire. By nightfall, a reddish glow appears at the western horizon. With Tom in her arms, Grace gazes at the fearful and exquisite disaster. Even Tom seems riveted, and when she looks into his dark eyes, she can see the unexpected light producing a silhouette. Tall pines, maples, an electric tower, a barn. How far away is the fire? How fast is it moving? She imagines the Indians would have seen the glow as a message of doom from the ancestors and would have taken to canoes along the river. Though Grace and her neighbors live near a beach, few of them have boats of any kind. A motorboat can't be launched from a beach. Unless the ocean is dead calm, a canoe is useless. Even rowboats are tied up at the town dock a few miles away. Two families that Grace knows of evacuated themselves by car earlier when the black Ford with a bullhorn cruised the streets telling people to take their most important possessions and get out of town. Over the sound of screened doors slapping, voices murmur and then shout. Reports of fires in Kennebunk preclude driving south. To drive west is to go toward the fire. To go east is to drive into the ocean. And to drive north is not without risk. There are rumors of small fires along the main road to Biddeford. Could she and Jean and the children make it to Cape Porpoise just up the coast? Could a boat be found there? Many of her neighbors are staying put to protect their houses. Few can imagine a fire advancing to the ocean, deliberately moving toward an absolute lack of fuel. By Jean's account, they have at least a day before they need to start worrying. This morning at breakfast, he called her an alarmist. Three words. She stares again at the glow of red at the horizon. Who lives out there? Have their homes already gone up in flames? There are no newspapers now, and any minute, according to Rosie, they'll lose power. She urged Grace to assemble candles in every room, which Grace thinks is more likely to produce a house fire than the still distant conflagration. I'm frightened, Rosie says when she enters Grace's kitchen at 7 in the evening. Don't be. Rosie hunches forward on the kitchen chair to rock Eddie in Tom's old cradle, while Claire and Ian color on paper on the floor.
If the house goes, we've got nothing, Rosie wails.
Grace remembers the woman who stood in front of her home on the waterfront, worried about tidal flooding. She said the same thing. Does that woman now feel safer than the rest of her neighbors, living so close to the water's edge? No insurance? Grace asks. Rosie shakes her head.
Oh, Rosie. We meant to get it, we did, but the money was always needed for something else. I suppose it's too late now?
I think it might be.
What'll we do?
The fire is still miles away, Grace says.
What will you take with you?
Grace has set aside a pile of belongings on the floor of the living room. Clothes, baby food, canned milk, a few photographs, two of Jean's most prized surveying antiques, all the important papers in the drawer of the living room desk, blankets, several bottles of water. How she will manage to get the provisions out of the house with two children in tow is an unsolved problem. Jean took the car in the morning, stating that he was going to help other men create a firebreak to stop the wildfire from nearing Hunts Beach. She wishes he would come home. Blankets, papers, clothes, water, Grace answers.
I can't focus. Do I take the sentimental or the practical?
A little of the first, more of the latter.
Will there be any warning at all?
Does a fire roll down a hill with such speed that it catches people before they can run away? Grace thinks of ancient Pompeii. The population was overwhelmed by moving lava. Is a fire faster than lava?
I heard Edith on the back porch sobbing this morning, Rosie reports. I felt sorry for her and almost went over there. And Tim says that the Bakers had the loudest fight he's ever heard.
Tempers are short. All that waiting for rain. And now the fear.
We knew in our bones that something bad was going to happen.
Did we? Asks Grace. To us?
The drought, the unnatural heat.
The early warning they didn't heed. Should they have been more prepared? For catastrophe? Who lives like that? Grace brings the supplies out to the back porch to be closer to the car when Jean comes for them. Something that looks like a bat skims the screen and startles Grace. But its flight is too slow and too close to the ground to be a bat. It seems to float to the sunburned grass and stay there, weightless. With caution, she opens the door to get a better look, and as she does, an insect flutters against her cheek. She slaps the bug away and watches the pieces drift to the ground. Not a bat, not a bug. Fragments of burned paper, carried on the wind. Rosie is back at Grace's door. Grace steps outside, and the pair move to the halfway point between the two houses so that each can listen for a child crying.
Where's Jean? Rosie asks.
He didn't come back.
Tim? Not back either.
It's after 9, Grace says.
You think they're still working on the fire break?
I guess.
You'd think they'd come home to be with their families, Rosie says.
In the near distance, Grace can hear motors revving.
If just one of them comes back, we could all cram into a car and get out. I can't believe this is happening to us.
It's not just us, Grace points out. If what we've heard is true, half of coastal Maine is on fire. There are inland fires, too.
Okay, says Rosie. Let's be sensible.
Grace smiles.
You can fit whatever you have in the carriage, right?
Rosie asks.
Not all. We have to be able to move.
I heard that people were stealing shopping carts from Shaw's, says Grace.
Why didn't I think of that?
Seriously? Stealing?
Do you think that matters when the stakes are the lives of your children?
Grace guesses not. Rosie snaps her fingers.
We have a canoe.
I don't know, says Grace. Pretty dangerous to push a canoe into the ocean at night with your children in it.
No, I'll put the kids and the stuff in it and drag it.
To where?
To the beach?
And then what?
The fire's not going to go all the way to the beach, insists Rosie.
I don't know.
It can't.
Sparks might reach us and our things.
Simple, Rosie says. We'll wet everything down.
And the kids?
Oh, Grace, I don't know. Does the fire look closer?
The silhouette has changed. 2 houses, an open field. Yes, the fire is closer, but for now she will keep that knowledge to herself.
Do you know where the fire break is?
Grace asks instead.
Near Route 1, maybe?
Grace turns back to the beach, certain that she has felt something new on her skin. Moisture, a cool breeze. She inhales deeply. The scent is unmistakable. She grabs Rosie's hand.
Can you smell that?
Grace asks. Rosie tips her face upward.
An east wind?
Grace nods. They stand a minute on the grass, hands clasped, taking in long breaths of refreshing wet air. It seems that other townspeople are just now noting it. Motors stop. Arguments halt mid-sentence.
We've been saved?
Rosie asks.
For now, anyway. God, I love an east wind.
Grace floats like a paper fragment into her house and up the stairs to where her children sleep. In a slow dance of exhaustion and relief, she slips into her summer nightgown and lies back on her pillow. She ought to stay awake and watch over her house and her children, in case the wind switches direction. She ought to go downstairs and wait in the kitchen for Jean. Will he be covered in soot, desperate for a glass of water? But won't the east wind have reached the men by now, signaling a few hours to go home to get some sleep? She rolls over to put her cheek to the pillow. She will take a cat nap and be refreshed and ready for whatever comes next. Hot breath on Grace's face. Claire is screaming, and Grace is on her feet. As she lifts her daughter, a wall of fire fills the window, perhaps a quarter of a mile back, if even that.
Where's Jean? Didn't he come home?
She picks Tom up from his crib and feels a wet diaper. No time to change him. She scurries down the stairs carrying both children. She deposits them in the carriage in the hallway and pushes it onto the screened porch. Claire begins to cough in the smoky air.
Sweetie,
Grace croons.
Have you saved us all?
She stuffs blankets, diapers, baby food, and water into the carriage behind the children. She loops the kids' clothes around the upper bits of metal and ties them in knots. She'll have to leave the mementos. Because she can't push the now too heavy carriage over the lip of the porch, she reverses it in order to drag it down the step. Claire is crying, and so is Tom, but Grace has no time to soothe them. As she maneuvers the vehicle to the edge of the grass, a bomb goes off, the explosion one Grace can feel right through her feet and legs. The children are silent, as if awed by the sound.
A fuel tank in a house on 7th Street,
she hears one man shout to another.
Sparks and embers swirl around Grace. There's chaos in the streets. She hears cars moving, women screaming. Balls of flame seem to leap from treetop to treetop, giving the fire a frightening momentum. A tree catches fire at the top, and the fire races down the trunk and into a house below. Another bomb. The fire turns tree after tree into tall torches. Fields resemble hot coals, for as far as she can see, there's an unbroken line of fire. Cars are traveling, but where can they go? An ember lands on the hood of the carriage. Grace swipes it off and begins to run. Heat and common sense push her to the seawall. A deer leaps across the street with her, chased by the freight train bearing down on all of them. She takes the children from the carriage and sets them on a blanket on the sand. On another blanket, she lays out what few provisions she has brought. Abandoning the carriage, she begins to drag both blankets away from the fire and closer to the water. When the sand feels wet underfoot, she stops. Smoke adds to the confusion. She spots, and then doesn't, Rosie dragging a canoe.
"Rosie!" Grace calls. "Grace, where are you?"
"Right at the water. There you are." Grace helps her friend drag the canoe beside the two blankets.
"Where's Jean and Tim?" Rosie wails.
"I have no idea," Grace says, shaken.
"Where are all the people going?"
Rosie asks.
"To the schoolhouse, I heard."
"That's crazy. The schoolhouse will burn if it hasn't already."
Grace kneels on the blanket to change Tom's diaper. His sleeper is dry enough to stay on. Grace can feel heat on her face.
"Oh, God,"
Rosie cries.
"What?"
"The Hinkle House just went. It's only one street back from us."
Grace has no words. When she glances up, the fire burning on the ground resembles hot jewels among the rocks and pebbles.
"Rosie, take what you can from the canoe and put it near the water's edge, then push the canoe out to sea."
"But..."
"It's wood. If an ember falls inside, it will bring the fire right to us. Wet your hair and the kids' hair."
Rosie follows Grace's instructions. She's glad that Rosie won't see her own house go up. Already, roof shingles are burning.
"Do my kids too,"
Grace yells to buy more time. The splendid maple next to Grace's own house turns orange in an instant, as if someone had switched on a light. The tree collapses. Grace can't see her screened porch, but she knows the fire will consume that next and lead straight into the house. She left the photographs, the papers, the layette, the antique tools. Rosie's house explodes, the fire having found the fuel tank in the basement. Rosie snaps her head up.
"Rosie, don't!"
Grace commands, and there must be something in her voice that makes her friend obey, because Rosie turns to the water and puts her face in her hands. Grace imagines the fire eating its way through her own home, the kitchen with the wringer washer, the hallway where the carriage is kept, the living room in which Grace made the slipcovers and drapes. An image of the fire climbing the drapes like a squirrel momentarily freezes her. Upstairs to the children's beds, her own marriage bed. All their belongings, gone. Everything she and Jean have worked to have, gone.
"Rosie, listen. Go down to the water's edge so that only your feet are in the water. Lay down facing the sand. Make an air pocket. And I'll bring you Ian and Eddie. Put a child under each arm and hold them close. Make air pockets for them, too. I'm going to soak your blanket and drape it over you. I'm going to cover your heads. Don't look up and don't reach out a hand or let your hair out from under the blanket."
Rosie is silent.
"Okay?"
Grace shouts.
"Okay,"
Rosie says. Grace races into the sea to wet the blanket. Men in jackets and caps carry children toward the water, as if in a great and horrible sacrificial act. The women with provisions follow. She lays the blanket over Rosie and her children just as she said she would. Then she sets her own children in the sand and wets another blanket. Tugging the dripping wool, she fetches Tom and lies down facing up, pulling the blanket to her face and anchoring it with her feet. She beckons for Claire to come to her. When she has the children securely beside her, she lets go for a second and flips onto her stomach, making three air pockets. She rolls the children over so that they are all face down in the sand. Holding her hair back with one hand, she drapes the blanket up and over their heads. She checks around Claire and Tom to make sure nothing is sticking outside the covering. She hears screams, not of pain, but of horror, and she guesses that the waterfront houses are about to go. People who have not managed to get out of town are trapped like rats running for the sea. She prays an animal will not step on her, or, worse, try to burrow inside. The heat on their heads and backs is just this side of bearable. The blanket won't stay wet for long.
"Rosie!" Grace shouts.
Grace can hear nothing.
"Rosie! Still here? Squiggle back into the water till it's up to your thighs, just short of the kids' feet. Why? Do it, please."
Grace follows her own instructions and is in water nearly to her waist. She wishes she had thought to make a cave for her stomach. She creates new air pockets for herself and the children.
"Whatever you do, don't look up. Rosie, did you hear me?"
"Yes."
"Did you look up?"
"Yes."
Grace takes shallow breaths, afraid she might inhale sand. She wonders if she and her children will die like this, the fire advancing to the dune grass at the seawall, and then igniting Grace's blanket. Would it be too late by the time she felt the pain, or would she have a few seconds to get Tom and Claire into the water up to their shoulders? She might have to dunk herself and the kids if the fire gets that close. Does sand burn? She can do nothing but wait until the fire exhausts itself. The seawater must be in the mid-60s, and she has begun to shiver under the blanket. She has on only her cotton nightgown. The children are hardly more dressed than she. She can't tell if the shivering is simply because of the cold, or if it stems from fear. Heat leaves the body quickly when one is lying on the ground, though the top of her feels as if it might sear at any minute. She would rather suffer the cold until the fire is well and truly out. How long will that take? Around her, she hears timbers crashing, grass crackling. How many people are on the beach now? She doesn't dare look. She wishes she could calm herself, but it's impossible with the shivering. She has only one task now, to save her children. And then Rosie's children and Rosie. The shaking becomes so severe, the children seem to catch it. Nature's way of keeping them warm inside. When she can no longer resist peeking, the moon is red. Burned trees fall to the ground amid showers of sparks. The entire town, for as far as Grace can see, is ablaze. Nothing moves but the fire. Hungry, angry, relentless. This must be what hell is like, she thinks as she lowers the blanket. Grace worries for her mother. She must be safe, she decides. Her two friends would have rescued her. Gladys has a car. Perhaps they evacuated her earlier, and her mother, having no way to communicate, could not alert Grace. Or maybe her mother is at the other end of the beach, over a mile away, hovering near the water, as she is. Claire begins to cry. Afraid that the child might inhale sand, Grace removes her arm from her daughter and as best she can fills the hole.
"Look at me," she says to Claire. "Just lie your head down facing me."
Grace brushes the sand from her daughter's face.
"Go to sleep now," she says.
She reaches back to cover her child with her arm. When Claire is settled, Grace turns to her son. His face is covered with sand. She fills his hole and turns his head to face hers. She can't understand his strange quiet. His eyes are open, and he is breathing, but he ought to be crying like his older sister. Instead, his expression is solemn, as if he were in shock.
She wishes the children would fall asleep. But how can they, when death threatens a mere 20 yards away? They know this is not a